Welcome to Cross-Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from U.S. tax regulations to the OECD's latest developments. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Global Leader. The Pillar 2 engine from PwC is a game changer for Pillar 2 modeling, provision, and compliance calculations. Built on a graph system utilizing over 20 years of international tax technology, this centralized rules engine is built by a team of Pillar 2 tax experts from around the globe. PwC's Pillar 2 engine is currently available as a service and will be licensable in July 2024. On this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks, we're back in Westminster Studios in St. Louis, Missouri, where I'm excited to be joined by Steve Cohart. Steve is an international tax partner with PwC in New York City and former advisor for the Center for Tax Policy and Administration at the OECD. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot for having me, Doug.
Well, Steve, it's great to finally have you on. We've been talking about this for a while. I will remind listeners, it's early August 2023. We're going to dive into the latest wave of OECD administrative guidance that we got on Pillar 2. But before we dive into that, I'm back in St. Louis. I've been traveling all over the world. As listeners know, we've been recording these from around the globe. It's now finally August. Steve, Europe is on holiday. You spent a couple years in Paris, so I'm kind of enjoying the time where things are slowing down, particularly now with the OECD. And I'm going to be taking you tonight to your first Busch Stadium baseball game. I know you're a big baseball fan and a Mets fan, but I wanted to ask you, do you have a favorite St. Louis Cardinal, or at least a memorable St. Louis Cardinal? Because we've had a lot of great series with the Mets over the years.
Yeah, Doug, as a Mets fan and of my generation, no favorite Cardinals, but I have vivid memories of game seven of the 2006 NLCS with, you know, Andy Chavez making on the Mets, making the game saving, what we thought was the game saving catch, only to have Beltran get struck out by Adam Wainwright looking to end the game in the series. So that's my St. Louis Cardinals memory. But, you know, given that our teams are competing for the battle of the basement this season, I'm looking forward to just having some fun tonight.
And Adam Wainwright, just for my baseball fan listeners, is still pitching in 2023. He's 42 years old. This is actually his last year. And I don't unfortunately think he's pitching tonight, but an amazing career. And I remember that series very, very well. And the Cardinals did go on to win the World Series that year. So it was a very memorable year for Cardinals fans. But all right, so let's get away from baseball, because I'm reminded that a very small fraction of the listening audience here that's interested in international tax is interested in baseball, but I can't help myself. So let's get to the good stuff as far as why people are actually here. So in July of 2023, the OECD released, I'll call it another tranche of guidance related to both Pillars 1 and Pillar 2. Maybe before we dive into some of the details, what were those four pieces of guidance or of documents, I maybe should say, that the OECD released?
Absolutely, Doug. So we got some documents on Pillar 1. Notably, we're still waiting for the final documentation around Amount A, in the sense that there's still some sticking points they've indicated, but that should be forthcoming soon. We got a consultation draft on Amount B. And then moving into Pillar 2, we got three important documents. We got the final version of the Globe Information Return. We got a Pillar 2 administrative guidance package on the rules. And then we also importantly finally got text with respect to the subject to tax rule, which I think we'll all get into these in a bit.
Right. And you mentioned kind of the final guidance on the Globe Information Return. And I think that we'll dive in a little bit more to that, but I still feel like there's a lot more information that we'd all love to see and understand, particularly as taxpayers are thinking about, and frankly advisors, what we need to do to actually comply with these rules, because it is still in my view looks like a list of more kind of data requirements than what we've traditionally seen in tax calculations, but a lot to unpack here. So we're going to set Amount B and Pillar 1 to the side here, I think, for a number of obvious reasons, particularly given that Pillar 2 is happening. January 1st, 2024 income inclusion rule. I will provide here an update for listeners that Korea, you know, as a follow-up to my last podcast with Michael Kim, Korea has officially published rules, won't be enacted until December, but I think high likelihood of enactment that their UTPR will be postponed. That has taken up a lot of oxygen on the cross-border tax talks, but the UTPR for Korea, it is Korea's intention to postpone that from 2024 to 2025. And then there's also some related guidance that we received from the OECD, but important for listeners to know that that guidance was actually released by Korea. So why don't we start with the subject to tax rule? Because this is, you know, there has not really been anything thus far providing any detail. So maybe, Steve, before we even dive into some of the specifics, remind listeners, what is the subject to tax rule? Because the income inclusion rule and UTPR has been the big focus so far.
Absolutely. So the subject to tax rule has always been a design element of Pillar 2. And the idea is that it's a treaty-based rule that would be implemented through a multilateral instrument that would allow source jurisdictions to essentially impose a first-in-time withholding tax to the extent that a specified cross-border payment is not subject to a nominal rate of tax in the recipient company of at least 9%. And it's a nominal rate test with a few caveats in the sense that if there's a preferential regime or something of that sort, you need to look at that. But otherwise, it's a nominal rate as opposed to the overall Pillar 2 effective rate for a jurisdiction. Supposed to be treaty-based rule and only the design intent is that it's only implemented between an inclusive framework member and a developing country when the developing country requests that the inclusive framework member update their treaty to include this STTR provision to allow essentially that source-based company to bring the rate of tax up to a maximum of 9%. So any already imposed withholding taxes need to be taken into account.
Yeah, and I think there are some specific language, and maybe in one of the footnotes, because I think kind of on first blush, you know, my initial reading without reading the footnotes, and I think you had pointed this out to me, that this really is designed to be implemented by developing countries. In other words, those countries that have not already adopted Pillar 2, including an IR, UTPR, and QDMTT.
Exactly. And I think the cutoff for a developing country is a gross national income of, I think, around $12,500 US. It's the World Bank standard. There's a published list. They've indicated that they'll continue to update based on on that list. And then important to note that if an STTR is applied, that is going to be treated as a covered tax for Pillar 2 purposes. And exactly, Doug, as you indicated, this is supposed to be a simple thing that developing economies can implement to allow them to get that first-in-time taxation right.
Yeah, and the things I think to note are what types of payments? I mean, it would seem to be a very broad list and inclusion of the types of payments that could be subject to this. So not just traditionally your dividends, interest, rents, royalties.
Right, but for example, services are included as well. So it's a very broad list of payments when this subject to tax rule is enacted between two countries.
Yeah, and the other point, just echo that you had mentioned, is that nominal rate is kind of a defined term, right, which is not to be confused with statutory rate, not to be confused with the globe rate or book effective tax rate. So here's another calculation that needs to be done to determine what is a nominal rate for purposes of the STTR.
Absolutely, because in the recipient jurisdiction, you'll need to look at what the corporate income tax rate is, and then what's the rate of tax being applied to this category of income? Is it being offset with incentives or credits? And then where do you come out when you go through this nominal rate computation for the STTR?
Yeah, there does appear to be this view of the OECD that the ability for taxpayers to be able to keep track in an unlimited amount of different tax calculations. And I think it's just going to be very challenging for taxpayers. I mean, I guess, first of all, we'll see if and when and how these are incorporated into treaties. But I guess the assumption, particularly where maybe there are some of these developing countries making payments to the U.S., any thoughts on the likelihood of the U.S.? And there's been a couple of movements on treaties lately, but any thoughts on how this may be incorporated with the U.S. and any of the treaties that they have with developing countries?
It would seem unlikely anytime soon, given, you know, the history we've had with tax treaties in the U.S. But in theory, the U.S. is a member of the inclusive framework, signed on to the October 2021 statement, which included the STTR. So we'll see when the first developing country asks the U.S. and when that is to incorporate it with the treaty, how that plays out.
All right. So something to keep an eye on, particularly, and something to be mindful of, because, you know, there's been a lot of discussion. We just hadn't received guidance so far. And so for taxpayers to be aware. Okay, so let's move to the Globe information return document that came out. Tell us a little bit about that, Steve.
Yep. So we received in December of 2022 the first draft of the Globe information return, which, you know, I think Globe information return is a little bit of a misnomer because it's a collection of data points that a jurisdiction will include in the design of its Globe information return and what that return must include, but it's not an actual template for the return, so to speak.
Right.
So we'll see design variations jurisdiction to jurisdiction in their Globe return. The original draft in December of 2022 required a great deal of granular data on a constituent entity by constituent entity basis for all jurisdictions subject to the all jurisdictions. The revised final Globe information return that we got seemed to respond somewhat to the feedback in the public consultation that took place, where the compliance burden for M&E groups was really highlighted around how difficult it's going to be to get this granular data on a constituent entity by constituent entity basis. And there's welcome relief in that there's this 5-year simplified transitional reporting framework that allows the Globe or Pillar 2 adjustments to be reported on an aggregate basis, either when there's no top-up tax due with respect to a jurisdiction or when top-up tax does not need to be allocated amongst constituent entities. And when this 5-year transitional simplified reporting framework applies, you can aggregate the constituent entity data, but it's important to note that all of the Globe computations are still required. All of the data points are still required. It's just that instead of needing to do it on an entity-by-entity basis, it can now be aggregate in that jurisdiction.
Yeah, and that last point is very important in that taxpayers are still going to have to do the calculations on a constituent entity by constituent entity basis. I think that there were a number of public letters and commentary to the OECD where taxpayers were concerned about just the amount of information that they had to disclose, particularly by constituent entity, and, you know, the fact that they did not want to disclose some of this information that could potentially be available to competitors, taxing authorities for whatever reasons. And so it seems like it feels to me a little bit more like a disclosure issue, because taxpayers are still going to need to do the calculations on a constituent entity basis to ensure that there's no top-up tax.
Yeah. So for sure, the computations are still going to be incredibly complex, relief in how it's reported. And then we also, in the final version of the GIR, got some more insight as to how jurisdictions will exchange the Globe information return. So the Globe information return will be filed either with the ultimate parent entity if they're in a jurisdiction that's adopted the rules, or filed with a designated filing entity if the UPE hasn't adopted the rules. And then that GIR can be exchanged amongst jurisdictions that have implemented the rules. And the design intent here is that when it's exchanged under an exchange of information agreement, that general information about the group would be shared, such as the structure and otherwise, but then only the information relevant to a jurisdiction's taxing rights would be forwarded on to the other relevant jurisdictions. Now, again, if you have jurisdictions applying the UTPR to the group, there may be many jurisdictions that are still being disclosed in that exchange of information because of the scope of the UTPR.
Yeah, the big challenge that I see coming out of this is that I think many of us were hoping for a form as opposed to this, what still feels to me like a list of data requirements. And I'd be interested in your take on this, but it feels to me like this is effectively like a minimum set of information that should be required to be included on a form. But effectively now they're giving various implementing jurisdictions kind of authority to develop their own forms as long as it includes that minimal amount of information. Nothing precludes it from potentially requesting even additional information, which from a compliance perspective for both taxpayers and advisors, without the uniform form that would apply, because this is a global tax, I think it could be a real challenge. But what's your view on that?
I completely agree with that. And I think there's this tension of Pillar 2 being a common approach, and we see it with the rules as well, where we expect to see differences between jurisdictions, that because it's going to be implemented under domestic law and consistent with the guidance out of the OECD, I think that inherently we'll see some variations not only in the design of the Globe return, but also in the way the rules are implemented. And I think that's just an inherent factor in that this is a common approach being taken under the domestic law of each implementing jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I just think from just an administrative perspective, both for taxpayers and tax authorities, my strong advice, if any of them are listening to this, would be to have a common form that is required and filed by all of the jurisdictions. Listen, the QDMTTs are a different story, and we'll get into that. But I'm not sure if that's going to happen. I think the hope was maybe we would see this in this guidance. It obviously didn't, to your point. So, but we'll continue to track that. But I think that filing for these globe information returns is still going to be a significant challenge. And certainly the simplified jurisdictional reporting is obviously welcome for taxpayers, but would love to see a little bit more uniformity from a forms perspective. All right, so let's move to the Pillar 2 administrative guidance, because there was a lot of juicy stuff in here. There was also a lot of stuff that was excluded or that wasn't included, I guess I should say. I don't know if it was intentionally excluded, but still a lot more questions. But let's start with the transitional safe harbor, and particularly for the UPE jurisdiction relief, I think they call it. What does that mean?
Yep. So we have a new transitional safe harbor. And as a reminder, we already had a set of transitional safe harbors that came out in December of 2022 based on country by country reporting. And we now have an additional transitional safe harbor only for the UPE jurisdiction. So it only applies with respect to one jurisdiction in the group, and that's the jurisdiction of the ultimate parent entity. And what this does is if a group chooses to avail themselves of this safe harbor, the UPE jurisdiction needs to have a corporate income tax rate over 20%. And if the group avails themselves of this safe harbor, it's an additional 1 year delay of the application of the UTPR, but only to the UPE jurisdiction. So it would delay the UTPR to 1-1 of 26 for the UPE jurisdiction. But with respect to the rest of the group, the UTPR still turns on from 1-1 of 25. And a trap for the unwary here is that in the UTPR safe harbor document, they tell us that a group can choose which safe harbor it applies with respect to the UPE jurisdiction. It can either apply the original transitional country by country safe harbors or this new transitional UTPR safe harbor. But it notes that if you apply the transitional UTPR safe harbor, that it triggers the once out, always out rule in our transitional CBCR safe harbors. And as a reminder, what that rule says is if you fall out of these transitional CBCR safe harbors, you cannot avail yourself of that transitional CBCR safe harbor in a subsequent fiscal year. So a group that is using the UTPR safe harbor, for example, on the US in 2025, cannot avail itself of the CBCR safe harbor in 2026 for the US, but would need to do the full globe computation on the US. So what I'm seeing in practice is that many groups are still sticking to the status quo from December of 22 and trying to meet the transitional CBCR safe harbor so that they can use that simplified reporting in 2026. But it's a welcome development that we have this fallback with a 1 year delay to the extent that a group can't meet the transitional CBCR safe harbor for 2025.
Yeah, and it was interesting to me on the language, because they did not, when they talk about this ultimate parent entity jurisdiction that hasn't implemented the Pillar 2 rules, has a greater than statutory rate than 20%, really feels like this was targeted at the US. And, you know, but potentially a reaction to some of the commentary that was received from House Republicans with respect to the potential ability for foreign subsidiaries of U.S. multinationals to be able to collect the top-up tax. And effectively, this gives a one-year delay to that potential ability for those foreign subs to be able to collect the U.S. top-up tax to the extent that the globe rate in the U.S. for those taxpayers is below 15. So I think a very, very interesting development, very important for U.S. multinationals, particularly for those that are taking significant incentives like R&D or for whatever other reasons may be below the 15%. But your caveat on like kind of making a conscious decision between the country by country safe harbor and this is really important. All right, so let's move on now to, there was some interesting information on the QDMTTs. And this is something particularly I've been interested in because, you know, the OECD had effectively acknowledged in prior guidance that a QDMTT could differ from the model rules commentary for an income inclusion rule in a UTPR. And the question that I have had is, and I've mentioned on the podcast, if the QDMTT base was different than the IR base, could you still potentially have a top-up tax for it in a jurisdiction where a QDMTT was implemented? So what did the OECD say about that?
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right that absent a safe harbor, we could have had this situation where you raise less top-up tax under a QDMTT. It was operating as a credit, so it would offset the top-up tax dollar for dollar. You still had to do both computations, and you could have wound up with additional top-up tax due under the rules. We now have this new permanent safe harbor that says for a qualifying QDMTT, that essentially the top-up tax for a jurisdiction is set to zero, operating in a similar manner to the other safe harbors. So when this safe harbor applies, the M&E group will only need to do one computation with respect to a jurisdiction. I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in practice, one, because it's a subset of QDMTTs that this safe harbor will apply to, and then two, even a qualifying QDMTT might not still be eligible for the safe harbor depending on an M&E group specific set of facts. So not only does the QDMTT need to be tested on an ongoing peer review basis, it also needs to be tested with respect to the application of that group's facts for what they call the switch-off rule, where the safe harbor can be switched off with respect to a specific group in certain circumstances.
Begs a lot of questions that I'm not going to ask you about on administrability of that particular rule, as well as a number of others. But we'll take the OECD at its word. We'll see how this shakes out, particularly from a peer review process. One of the other interesting things in the QDMTT was the ability for jurisdictions to choose kind of the accounting standard for the base of the tax. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I was surprised by this development because we can see that is probably the place where we will see the largest variation in result from a computation under the globe rules with respect to the denominator and the QDMTT because of the fact that the QDMTT guidance allows a jurisdiction to choose when it legislates whether it will use the local financial accounting standard or the consolidated financial accounting standard of the group. But I note here that there's some instances where this can be switched off. For example, if the local statutory year is a different year end than the consolidated financial accounts. Mm-hmm. But an interesting development that a QDMTT based on local financial accounts can still meet this safe harbor, just noting that it's a legislative choice for the jurisdiction. It's not something that the M&E group can pick and choose which base it uses for the QDMTT.
Yeah, good point. It's a choice of the jurisdiction, but you can imagine that as jurisdictions are implementing from an administrability perspective for taxing authorities, that they would prefer to choose the local accounting standard as opposed to trying to educate, you know, the taxing authorities on US GAAP or IFRS or whatever the accounting standards may be. So it would appear to me that this opens the door for these jurisdictions to be able to use the local accounting standards. And again, from an administrability perspective, it would seem that that would be the choice. But time will tell as we see these rules get implemented.
It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And even the jurisdictions that choose that, I think, will probably still be getting a decent number of QDMTT returns based on the consolidated financial accounts because of some of the guardrails they put on when you can use the local financial accounting standard, for example, like the year-end difference that I mentioned.
Right. Yeah, so still a real big challenge for taxing authorities as they review these rules. What did it tell us about filing? We talked about the globe information return, but any insight on what returns may look like from for qualified domestic minimum top-up taxes?
Right, and I think here we're going to see even more variation than we see with the globe return because the QDMTT is a domestic tax. It can differ from the globe rules in authorized ways. We already know, for example, about the allocation of cross-border taxes being different. So not only will the computation be different, but each jurisdiction is likely to have its own form. And while, you know, they've made some comments around trying to coordinate the process of what a QDMTT return looks like, I think given that we don't have a standard globe information return, it's pretty far-fetched to think we're going to get a standard QDMTT return. And I think we're likely to see it follow the model of the local corporate income tax return in many jurisdictions. It might even be a schedule, for example.
Yeah. So just a lot of complexity for multinational enterprises that operate in a lot of jurisdictions because not going to be a standardized return for the QDMTTs either. There was also something very interesting, and frankly, we could probably spend 40 minutes on this point, but just want to highlight to listeners that there was some specific language related to if taxpayers would make challenges to qualified domestic minimum top-up taxes under either, for example, constitutional reasons or investment treaties, which seemed to be quite a big step that the OECD is taking. But can you give us just a quick synopsis of that?
Sure. So what the guidance says is that to the extent that a QDMTT is challenged either under a constitutional basis or an investment treaty, that essentially the amount challenged is treated as not paid.
Yeah, and so that amount just simply comes out of the, if you have an IR calculation, it kind of throws the QDMTT, that safe harbor, out, and you could still be subject to either IR or UTPR.
Exactly.
So begs a lot of questions with respect to, you know, what how these various rules layer onto each other, but I thought a fairly bold move in that respect from the OECD, with potentially long established constitutions and or investment treaties. There was also a change to the treatment of certain types of taxes for the QDMTT. And I think there were a number of us that weren't sure if that was an intentional policy decision or if it was potentially maybe something that was left out. But what were those taxes?
Sure. So the original QDMTT guidance excluded two categories of cross-border taxes. So CFC taxes and branch taxes that would otherwise be allocated under the GLOBE rules from the constituent entity owner to the constituent entity were excluded. So if you have a CFC tax being allocated under the GLOBE rules, you don't get that for a QDMTT. And that was in the guidance that we got earlier this year. Interestingly, the guidance earlier this year did not include cross-border hybrid taxes or cross-border distribution taxes. And what the guidance we got this July tells us is that to the extent that you have one of those categories of taxes imposed by the constituent entity owner, that those are also excluded. So bringing those categories into consistent policy with the two that we already had.
Okay. So let's move on to what is referred to as market transferable credits. And I dedicated a whole podcast to this issue, really related to the green energy credits that came in the Inflation Reduction Act that are not refundable, but were transferable. I think this was a particular focus for U.S. Treasury as they had discussions with the OECD insofar as how to treat those, with the risk that I've highlighted on a number of podcasts that, you know, non-U.S. jurisdictions, if the U.S. was sitting below or ultimately when the UTPR come in, could effectively collect a top-up tax if these weren't considered good, qualified, refundable tax credits. So I think many of us were expecting or hoping that the OEC would provide guidance that tells us that these types of credits are qualified refundable tax credits, but they took a slightly different approach.
Yes, this has been a hot issue for a while, and we finally have some resolution, an interesting resolution at that, in the sense that we have this new category of tax credits, because we previously had our qualified refundable tax credits, which, as a reminder, are taken into account as income and also included in your numerator. So dilutive on your rate, but not to the same extent as a non-refundable tax credit, which is all the other tax credits that aren't QRTCs, which simply comes out of the numerator. So now we have this marketable transferable tax credit, or MTTC, concept. And here they're treated essentially the same as QRTCs in the sense that they are taken into account as income for GLOBE purposes, but also remain in your numerator. And what we need to have is a transferable tax credit. So there's a legal transferability standard, but then the tax credit, there also needs to be an established market for these credits where they're trading at least 80 cents on the dollar, essentially, to meet this category of credits. But welcome relief. Note, though, that it's still dilutive to the Pillar 2 calculation, right? Just nowhere near as bad as if it was a non-refundable credit.
Yeah, that's really important. This isn't just the panacea for that, because it can still be diluted, but absolutely welcome guidance, particularly for those multinationals that are taking advantage of the Inflation Reduction Act credits. I would encourage taxpayers to spend some time, though, because there are a myriad of different credits, not just in the IRA, but in the CHIPS Act as well, and just doing the diligence to make sure that you can qualify, because there are really, you know, some very specific requirements to be able to meet those definitions.
And the record keeping around how is a taxpayer going to prove that there's a market? And, you know, with some credits, it may be easier than others, but I think that's going to be an open question as we head into these rules. This marketability standard, how does a taxpayer document that?
Right. Because there may not be an established, like, security market for these things. But that's a great point, Steve. All right. So kind of want to cover just quickly, some other important provisions, but not go into a ton of details. One, first, with respect to currency conversion rules. So they gave us specific guidance, first of all, on translating the threshold. So, for example, like the 750 million euro threshold, how is that translated if you've got non-euro functional currencies?
Right. So there's a lot of places in the GLOBE rules, as many of us know, where there are amounts set out in euros. There's many thresholds for de minimis and things like that. And we simply we're given guidance that tells us to look back to the rate for the prior December to calculate those thresholds and apply them to the group.
Yeah. So the average rate in December for the year before,
exactly,
for purposes of translating the these various thresholds, I call them, for lack of a better word. And the 750 million euro, to your point, it's just one of them. That's just to get you in the initial gate. And then there are a whole bunch of other thresholds located throughout, found throughout these rules. All right. Now, what about translating top-up taxes? This was a bit of a surprise for me because there is a question after you do all of your constituent entity analysis and then you have to translate the various top-up taxes. What did the OECD tell for implementing jurisdictions how to deal with that?
Essentially, that they could take a reasonable approach. And, you know, this is one of those areas where we're going to see, I think, a good bit of variation. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, and that makes it really challenging for taxpayers as they're trying to do these calculations that if jurisdictions can either do it on average or spot, or, you know, if they look at December the year before, December the year of, I mean, it creates significant complexities for doing these different types of calculations if there are differences in the jurisdictions insofar as how they translate this. So just something else for taxpayers and advisors to be aware. All right, so the last piece I wanted to mention was the substance-based income exclusion. And maybe I'll just fly by. I think there were sort of six key pieces and maybe just get a quick reaction or a summary of what we saw on the substance-based income exclusion. First, there's some guidance with respect to interjurisdictional assets and employees.
Yeah. So there, you know, we've been waiting for a long time for guidance around mobile assets and how to take those into account. So now we have guidance that if an asset is predominantly mobile, that you can track it based on the time of use in jurisdictions. So some helpful guidance there.
All right. Number two, simplification.
This one I think is really helpful because many groups had indicated that, you know, computing the substance-based income exclusion is going to be quite an exercise. And what the guidance tells you is that you don't need to compute it to the last dollar. What you can do is you simply compute the SBIE, and if it's less than 100%, that's still okay. You can essentially claim what you calculate out and can prove.
All right. Stock number three, stock-based compensation.
So there's an election under the GLOBE rules to align essentially book and tax for purposes of your stock-based comp in the denominator. And there was an open question of, well, stock-based comp in your payroll factor of substance-based income exclusion, if you've made the election, do you follow the election or do you follow book? And they've told us that for the substance-based income exclusion, you follow book regardless of whether you made the election.
All right, four leases. Now this could be a long, but can you give us a summary of the leases?
Yep. So on leases, essentially, there's now an option in some cases for a lessor to take a substance-based income exclusion with respect to property held for lease. But I think there's going to be some real challenges around how you calculate the amount that they're able to take because there's some reference to essentially the operating value of that lease for the lessee.
Right. And so that was a curious one to me because they're going to have to require to get an exchange of information between these two parties to understand their carrying value. And that still begs a lot of questions for those that do these type of operating leases that also where those assets can be in multiple different jurisdictions, that I think there's still a lot of guidance that's needed, again, for particularly more for those in the shipping and the airline industry. I think there's certainly some additional guidance that would be welcome to understand how that works. All right, number five, impairment losses.
So here, real quick, on substance-based income exclusion, if you have an impairment loss with respect to an asset that's included, you have to essentially take that out. So you'll lose that benefit in your SBIE, but when it reverses, you can take it back into account.
All right. And then finally, the last one on the substance-based income exclusion, reductions due to an ultimate parent entity that is potentially subject to this deductible dividend regime.
High level, if you have a deductible dividend regime, there's a pro rata reduction to your substance-based income exclusion for the amount that you're essentially getting the benefit for under that deductible dividend regime.
Which makes sense, but just another calculation complexity. And so for those that are not watching this on YouTube and listening, Steve did all of that without any notes at all. So very, very impressive, Steve. All right. So we talked about what was included in the In the guidance, there's still a whole lot of open questions. And maybe what can we expect, Steve, in your view, from future guidance? And then my follow-up question is going to be, how the heck are implementing jurisdictions going to get all this stuff incorporated into law by January 1st, 2024? But let's start with the beginning. Maybe what are some things that you potentially expect in future guidance, or a couple of highlights?
Yeah. So I think the big one for U.S. GAAP filers is going to be guidance around transactions accounted for at cost, common control transactions. We got guidance in February that says when there's one of these transactions, the transferor needs to take the gain into account at arm's length under Article 3.2.3. But it said there would be future guidance on how you treat it in the acquiring company. I had expected that to be in the pack of guidance we got this July. It wasn't there. So I'd imagine that is still forthcoming. And that's going to be driving some very big differences in outcomes for U.S. GAAP filers and how they treat the acquisition of an asset in that acquiring company, whether they take basis or a deferred tax asset. So that's a big one that I think we're still waiting for. I think, you know, we're all still, you know, very eager to see meaningful simplifications and permanent safe harbors. So hopefully we have some of those coming. In terms of timing, the EU jurisdictions and many others are aiming to legislate by the end of this year so that the rules turn on from 1-1 of 24. And this package of guidance indicated there'll be more guidance coming and that it'll be released in some cases on an as-ready basis. So I think, you know, we can expect to see guidance continuing to come out of the inclusive framework as it's agreed. But I think that it's likely that we'll see that continue past the end of this year. And there's this open question of what happens when a jurisdiction legislates and we have a piece of guidance that isn't just a mere interpretation, but for example, the marketable transferable tax credits adds a whole new category of tax credits to the rules. If we have a piece of guidance that changes or supplements the rules, are jurisdictions able to incorporate these changes from the OECD without having to go through the whole legislative process again? And I think some jurisdictions are planning to make accommodation for that, and others may have constitutional challenges or legislative challenges with adopting these changes without going through the legislative process. So I think especially in the beginning, we'll have these growing pains of potentially significant differences between the legislation and various jurisdictions under their, you know, that they've implemented under domestic law.
Yeah. In other words, they could end up being staggered, right? Depending on when a particular jurisdiction laws were enacted. And then also depending on, you know, some jurisdictions have said that they can take this quote unquote ambulatory approach and effectively incorporate future guidance just kind of automatically, so to speak. Which, you know, I think certainly gives the OECD a lot of authority for those jurisdictions. You know, there's some that have said that, oh, well, as long as it's all interpretive, it can be incorporated kind of by regulation. And that's kind of wearing my U.S. hat. And I appreciate that there are specifics in various jurisdictions. But point being that you don't have to go, that those jurisdictions don't have to go through the full legislative process. But to your point, there still seems to be a lot of substantive material changes. And it first of all begs the question for the EU and the EU directive, you know, how substantive are these changes? Are those EU jurisdictions able to incorporate those? Are they significant deviations from the EU directive? And then, you know, as additional guidance comes out, how does it get incorporated? Can it be regulatory? Does it need to be legislative? But I think what I'm expecting is like, we're just going to have this kind of staggered potentially approach where, depending when the current, when a jurisdiction's implemented the rules, it could be different until things settle out in the next few years. So as those developments occur, we'll certainly talk about it on the Cross Border Tax Talks podcast. But Steve, very great to finally have you on. Fantastic insight, and look forward to future podcasts on additional administrative guidance and Pillar 2 developments.
Likewise. Thanks for having me, Doug.
So thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks. Thank you, Steve Cohart, a New York-based international tax partner at PwC. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Global Leader. Stay tuned for another exciting edition of the Cross Border Tax Talks podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.